I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Joaquin Guzman Loera is 5'6" tall, but as El Chapo, a legendary figure in the world of Mexican drug cartels, he looms large. The mythology surrounding him and the violent history of the Sinaloa drug cartel have been front and center in the international press for the past few months, as El Chapo stood trial in a federal court on 10 counts of drug-related charges. He was found guilty on all of them, and pending appeal, he'll spend the rest of his life in prison. With the idea of a wall commanding so much attention in the conversation about immigration and drug trafficking, what did we learn in this dramatic trial that can help inform our approach to border security? My guest today has a unique perspective on the trial and on the war on drugs. William Purpura was one of the three lawyers who defended El Chapo. He joins me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. In a rambling press conference Friday afternoon, President Donald Trump repeated his claims about the efficacy of a wall to, among other things, stop the influx of drugs into the United States. His emergency declaration, which of course will be challenged in court, is the president's latest attempt to make good on a central promise of his campaign. Today on Midday, a conversation about one of the most high-profile federal drug prosecutions in history. It came to a conclusion last week in a Brooklyn courtroom with the conviction of the Mexican drug kingpin known as El Chapo. The guilty verdict on 10 counts against Joaquin Guzman Loera came after a 3-month trial and, for federal prosecutors, 3 decades of investigation into the huge drug trafficking enterprise known as the Sinaloa Cartel. Guzman grew up in extreme poverty in the Sinaloa Mountains in northwestern Mexico. By the time he was extradited to the U.S. to stand trial in 2016, he had become a very rich man, a mythical figure who was famous for his uncanny ability to escape imprisonment. He has been sentenced to life in prison, which will likely mean he will spend it in a maximum security prison in Colorado. It is unlikely that he will be escaping from prison again anytime soon. His lawyers say they will appeal the verdict. His actual sentencing happens in June, but that is what the law mandates he be sentenced to. The three lawyers who defended him are considered some of the best trial attorneys in the country, and one of them lives right here in Baltimore. William Purpura has been involved in several high-profile cases, including the defense of Daniel Hursel, one of the Baltimore City police officers convicted in the Gun Trace Task Force scandal, and Michael Vaughn, a former Maryland delegate from Prince George's County, who was sentenced to 4 years in prison in a bribery case last fall. William Purpura joins me here in Studio A. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. And as soon as we can work out a couple of technical glitches, we will be streaming our conversation on the WYPR Facebook page. Bill, it's good to see you, sir.
Tom, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So you have a really unique perspective on this man, this mythological figure. He's a folk hero. There have been songs written about him in Mexico, and he is has been quite busy in the trade of drug trafficking over a long period of time. Let's sort of start at the beginning. How did you meet him, and how did you get involved in this trial?
Yeah. Tom, approximately about 15 years ago, another lawyer from Washington, Eduardo Balarezo, and I started representing people from Central and South America, and our name was bandied about, and eventually we represented Alfredo Beltran Leyva Mochimo, who is the cousin of Joaquin Guzman, and from our name was referred to him, and we, plus about 20 other lawyers throughout the United States, went to visit him, and he chose myself, Balarezo, and Jeff Lichtman from New York City to represent him.
So you were auditioning for the job, essentially.
We did. We did. We went a couple times to audition. Yeah. It was a very interesting audition, too.
Yeah. What did the audition entail? Oh,
good question, Tom. You know, every client, whether it's Joaquin Guzman or anyone else, wants to know who you are, what have you done, and what can you do for me? And, you know, what I've found over the years is just to be absolutely honest with the person. And you tell them that, you know, the evidence is overwhelming. You have very little option here except to go to trial. There's no plea offer on the table here, so we're not even going to discuss a plea. And we'll do the best we can do. And I think he was satisfied with that. And I believe that he is satisfied that we did do the best we could do, especially with the cooperators, the 13 cooperators we faced during the trial.
And in that process, were you privy, for example, at that juncture when you weren't, you hadn't yet been hired as his lawyer, were you privy to the case that the government had against him? Or was this stuff that you had gleaned from the press report?
The answer is no. We gleaned it through indictments throughout the United States involving the cartels. He has seven other indictments. And so there's kind of a speaking indictments in other districts, which give you an idea who are involved in those particular cases, who pled guilty in those cases. And those people who plead guilty are normally people who are going to cooperate eventually. We did not know who the 13 cooperators were until 30 days before the commencement of trial, so not until October of 2018.
And when you talked to him and had this sort of situation where you had to be realistic with him and you asked him to be realistic, what were the expectations at that point? What were his expectations? What did he think a best case scenario might be? I mean, did he expect to be exonerated?
You know, if... the question, I believe he realistically knew what he was facing in this particular case. What he expected was, first, he had no idea what the American system of justice was really like. So it was all new to him. So he was learning on the fly. And what he wanted to do, he wanted to be a participant. He wanted to know what's happening. What do they have against me? What are you going to do for me in court? What's court like? What's a jury like? All these basic questions. And he absorbed all this information quickly. And what's interesting is he actually wasn't even literate. He didn't learn to read and write till he was 42 years old. And he was able to absorb everything, all the technicalities we told him, everything, in a very short period of time.
So it sounds to me like he was also a very hands-on client. This is a person who wasn't saying, okay, you guys go take care of this and tell me how it turns out. He was in the mix the whole time?
Yeah, through his history of alleged narco-trafficking from the early 80s through 2016, he's been a hands-on person. He's a hands-on person in everything he does. He's a micromanager, and he was a hands-on person in this particular case. He really wanted to know, what are you doing? I know more about this witness than you do, so listen to me what I have to say on this.
You're sounding like a very experienced defense lawyer when you say he is alleged narco-trafficking. I mean, he talked to Rolling Stone magazine a few years ago and admitted to killing somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 people. But That's what he told Rolling Stone.
I don't think he said that to Rolling Stone. I think that's another myth. I know what he said to Rolling Stone. I know what the tape says to Rolling Stone. What he admitted was that he was a narco-trafficker early on and that he got out of the business and he spoke about the business itself. And actually, the tape was played during the trial itself.
So there's reports about it. And the team, three lawyers, and you also had two paralegals helping you. When you were hired, when was that and how long was the time in between when you got hired and the time that the trial started? How long did you have to prepare for this case?
I was hired literally 1 year before the commencement of the trial itself. So the trial started in November of 2018, and I entered my appearance and was hired November of 2017.
And entering your appearance is when you officially register with the court as one of the people representing.
Prior to that, Eduardo Balarezo, about 2 months before, entered his appearance. So he's officially representing Joaquin Guzman at that point. And our paralegals, we were lucky to have these two brilliant young ladies who delayed entrance into NYU law and into Harvard law for a year so they could work with us. And they were just invaluable. And hopefully they learned something from this case, particularly not to do criminal defense.
You really think that's the takeaway that they had from this?
After a year and a half of this, probably that is their takeaway.
Well, it's one way to learn, I suppose. Of course, last I checked, lawyers don't work for free. And in order to be compensated by El Chapo, you are going to have access to some of his assets, which you know, reputedly are considerable. But I would imagine that a big part of the government's case was that they're going to seize all of those assets. How does it work? I mean, if he indeed is a very rich man, where are his assets? Who has access to them? And how was the defense team compensated? And did that require some negotiations with the feds themselves?
Well, reputedly, he has $14 billion in assets, and that's the forfeiture figure that the government is seeking in this particular case. And since 1980 through his final arrest in 2016, the government of Mexico and or the government of the United States has seized literally zero assets. So whether the figure is more myth than actual legend, we're not sure. We have to go through what's called OFAC because he's on the OFAC list.
And what does OFAC mean?
OFAC is the Department of Treasury, because he's a person who is not allowed to do business with any banks or United States citizens. So you have to obtain a license to do business with him in order to obtain funds. And the funds that we received came from various sources, which were friends and or family members, and it was somewhat vetted by the government. And obviously, I think the government felt that they'd rather have retained counsel than to pay a large amount of money and to overburden the federal defender's office in New York City.
Right. So any defendant in a federal prosecution, like any local prosecution, it has the right to a federal public defender. But that would have cost the government a bunch of money?
It would have cost the government a large amount of money. They had literally three federal defenders and a full-time staff of law clerks working with Mr. Guzman originally, because the federal defender's office first entered their appearance in New York for Mr. Guzman. And they were really overwhelmed by this type of representation.
And so in a kind of interesting way, the federal government was getting a better deal, allowing some of his assets to be used to pay you and your team.
You would think so.
Yeah.
We spent money in Brooklyn while we were there, and we pay tax on all the money we receive. And so it seems that's the better way for the system to work.
The defense in this case lasted 30 minutes. You mentioned there were 13 cooperators, so you heard, you know, months and months of testimony against Mr. Guzman. And then when it was your team's turn, that lasted 30 minutes.
Yeah.
So the dichotomy between those two facts is interesting. How did you come to the decision to develop the strategy that you ended up developing?
Well, the strategy was not in the actual defense of 30 minutes, which was presented. Now, keep in mind, as much as Mr. Guzman micromanages, we have three lawyers working this case as well. And we all don't agree as to what would be or would not be good strategy in a particular case. It was Mr. Lichtman, who's obviously a very experienced trial lawyer in New York City, out of Manhattan, represented Gotti years back and got a hung jury for him. John Gotti Jr.
Yeah.
In 2005, thought that it would be appropriate to put a witness on for what's called a prior inconsistent statement. And you know, for what it was worth, I don't think it helped us, and I certainly don't think it hurt us. Normally, in a criminal defense case, in most criminal defense cases, the defendant obviously does not have to put any evidence on. And our defense in this particular case was that the 13 cooperators were not credible for a myriad of reasons, and therefore you shouldn't trust what they have to say.
But did you at any point actually deny Mr. Guzman's involvement in any of the crimes the government alleged?
Yeah, I think the theory of the case was that Guzman was involved in narco-trafficking early on. He grew up, as you indicated, in Sinaloa, in the area of Culiacan, in the region itself, in a little town called La Palma. And in that area of La Palma, the little town that he grew up in, they have large poppy fields. That's in the Golden Triangle of Mexico. They have poppy fields and huge marijuana fields, and they've had those forever. And everyone seems to be in that business. And so clearly, early on, he was in that business. And prior to 1993, that he was out of that business, and that the myth of Chapo continued based on events which occurred in 1993. That, in essence, was the defense, and that there's a person, Miles Zambada, who I've mentioned before to you, who has been trafficking in drugs from in the Sinaloa cartel, literally the leader, from the early 80s right through 2016. And Miles Zambada is still there trafficking, and he's never been arrested, unlike Chapo.
Do you believe in your heart that Mr. Chapo got out of the drug trafficking business in 1993? And do you need to believe that in your heart in order to defend him?
Tell him if I had to believe my heart, all my defenses, I'd be out of business. It's not our job to make that decision. It's the jury's job to make that decision, and that's what makes the system work. I believe in my heart that we go in there and try the best we can do and take apart the government's case and or the state's case, and the state believes in their heart they're going to rehabilitate that case and present it. And when both sides are working hard like that, the system works. And in this case, we both worked hard. Six government lawyers, three defense attorneys, and a jury who deliberated for 6.5 days before they came to a verdict.
William Papura was part of the defense team for El Chapo, who was convicted last week on 10 counts, including continuing criminal enterprises, for which the sentence is life in prison. When we return from a quick break, we'll have more of William Papura's unique perspective on this high-profile trial that attracted international attention. We're having a little problem with our screen today, but no problem with the phone. So if you'd like to give us a call, 410-662-8780, and my terrific staff will figure out some way of letting me know what you'd like to talk about and what your name is. Our email address, that's a sure bet, midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR, and we are indeed up and running on Facebook, where we are streaming our conversation on the WIPR Facebook page. Before we go to a break, we have sad news to report in the world of the arts. The internationally acclaimed jazz singer Ethel Ennis died yesterday at her home in Baltimore from complications related to a stroke. Ethel was an artist of thrilling talent, a singular musical imagination, and unforgettable grace. The list of greats she performed with includes Benny Goodman, Louis Armstrong, Miles Davis, Cab Calloway, and dozens of others. She was a groundbreaker on and off the stage. I had the chance to perform with Ethel once, and as one of the many people blessed with that chance, I will always remember her as an incredibly dynamic presence and a lovely, dear friend. Our hearts go out to her husband, Earl Arnett. Here she is in a 1964 recording, singing the classic jazz standard, "I Only Have Eyes for You." Ethel Ennis was 86 years old.
Are the stars out tonight? I don't know if it's cloudy or bright, for I only have eyes for you, dear. The moon is high, but I can't see a thing in the sky, 'cause I only have eyes for you. I don't know if we're in a garden or on a crowded avenue.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, a conversation about the Green New Deal, a proposal to address climate change in a dramatic way. Is the Green New Deal, as proposed by some Democrats, the right way to respond to climate change? I'll be joined by Tom Pelton of the Environmental Integrity Project, Bob Sussman, he's a former EPA official in the Clinton and Obama administrations, and Julian Noisecat of the Environmental Policy Team at 350.org. So the Green New Deal, that's what we're talking about tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest for the hour is the acclaimed trial attorney William Papura. 20 years ago, he was honored with the John Adams Award for Outstanding Representation of Indigent Federal Defendants, and he is one of just a few lawyers elected to the American College of Trial Lawyers. He is considered an expert in death penalty cases, and he is known for taking on some very high-profile clients, including Joaquin Guzman Loera, known as El Chapo. Mr. Guzman was found guilty last week in a federal court in Brooklyn, New York. He is scheduled to be sentenced on June 25th. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, to drop us a tweet. You find us at @MiddayWIPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWIPR. And we are streaming our conversation on the WIPR Facebook page. I know it's a fool's errand for any defense attorney or prosecutor, for that matter, to guess, you know, what happens in a jury deliberation. When the jury got the case and they began to deliberate. Were you surprised ultimately that it took 6.5 days? Was that more or less, or how did the length of time of their deliberation strike you?
You know, in the Eastern District of Brooklyn, it's a wonderful district. It's made up of Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island, and the demographics are very varied. This particular jury, which was remarkable, over 3 months, everyone showed up on time, including the 6 alternates. No one was sick. No one complained. So they took their job really serious. So it didn't surprise me that they wanted themselves, which they should do, is not listen to the government. Let's put aside the defense cross-examination, and let's take a look at the evidence ourselves and put it back together. So 6.5 days for a one defending case is a fairly long time for a jury to deliberate, and they did in this particular case. And I'm not going to question the results of their deliberations. I will say they did a really fantastic job.
They were not sequestered, right? It
what's called partially sequestered. Partially sequestered means, number one, they were an anonymous jury, so no one knew their names. Number two, as you mentioned earlier, this case generated a lot of media attention, and we had court sketch artists there on a daily basis, and they could not do the faces of the jurors themselves. And number three, the jurors met in a central location each day, and they were picked up by the United States Marshal Services and then escorted to the courthouse.
And when Mr. Guzman was escorted to the courthouse, he went across the Brooklyn Bridge. They closed the bridge down every day just for him to cross it, right?
He did. It's probably the most remarkable video you can possibly see. They had, how many police cars? 12 police cars, special unit vehicles involved, and they actually closed the Brooklyn Bridge, which crosses over well over 100,000 people. It's only a free bridge going in and out of New York City. On a daily basis when they had to bring him in. And thankfully for the people of New York and Brooklyn in particular, that they had other locations for him on the Brooklyn side when the case started.
The term of art that folks in the legal profession use is a flight risk. I suppose if anyone were a flight risk, it might be Mr. Guzman, having in fact flown on 2 separate occasions in the last 20 years.
Yeah, I think actually the government would probably consider more than 2 separate occasions. They had him trapped supposedly in 2012 before escapes me, but apparently it was another tunnel escape at that point. So there were many escapes. He was hunted for many, many years. And obviously the last escape in 2015, July 11th, was probably the most dramatic and interesting escape.
Let me have you put those headphones on. We're going to take a call from Anne in Baltimore. Anne, welcome to Midday with William Papura.
Thanks for taking my call. And it is related to a concern of his escape or safety of the other prisoners. And I had 2 questions. Where will he be held while he is on appeal? You don't have to say exactly where, but like what state? And how long do you think the appeal will take? And I'm assuming, you know, he'll be in the same place while this appeal is taking place.
All right, thanks for the call, Ann.
And I can tell you that in all federal cases, once a person is sentenced, the custody then goes to the Bureau of Prisons. Based on the Bureau of Prisons indicating at this point that he is under what's called secure administrative measurements, he will be sent to the maximum security facility, which is ADX Florence, Colorado, where he'll be placed on a special housing unit in there. And he will remain there through the appeal, and he will remain there if he's unsuccessful on the appeal for the remainder of his life.
Thanks for that call, Ann. I appreciate it. Let's go to Saul in Baltimore. Saul, welcome to Midday with Bill Papura.
So, Mr. Papura, I'd like to know if there was testimony about political corruption in Mexico and in the United States, and what the result of that testimony might be for those politicians.
Yeah. Well, there was a lot of testimony about political corruption in Mexico in particular, and it went all the way up to the presidency, and the prior presidents have responded in numerous media reports denying any involvement or denying receiving money. But
Former President Enrique Peña Nieto was accused of taking $100,000, something like that.
It's actually $100 million.
Oh, $100 million.
We didn't talk in thousands. We talked in millions.
I guess. All right.
We didn't talk in kilos. We talked in tons. Yeah, everything was larger in this case. So, yeah, there was a lot. And there was actually some talk about corruption involving cooperators influencing local American agents there, either through direct money bribes or through allegations of inappropriate affairs with various women in the area.
And thanks for that call, Saul. We appreciate it. In terms of security, were people concerned about the security, for example, the safety of the jurors? Were you and the defense team concerned about your safety? I mean, anytime people have associations and you know, close relationships with people in Mr. Guzman's business, regardless of when he may or may not have gotten in or out of it, there are often concerns about, you know, collateral damage, as it were.
Yeah. Well, the United States Marshals Service was in charge of the jurors' safety and protection, and they were taking, they did an excellent job in taking care of the jury. So I don't think there was any concern. There was no report of any concern or any attempt to influence any of the jurors. As far as our safety was concerned, the U.S. Marshals were equally concerned with our safety as well as the prosecutor's safety. The prosecutors, their building is literally maybe 100 yards away from the courthouse, but they arrived each day with police escort right to the basement of the courthouse, so they were not exposed to the public whatsoever. The marshals were concerned about any emails we were receiving or any texts we were receiving about if we had any concerns, and you know, we were lucky we did not, and I did not feel threatened whatsoever.
There were several of Mr. Guzman's former lieutenants in the Sinaloa cartel who testified. Do you have a sense of how the government was able to induce these folks to turn on their former boss and to cooperate with the prosecution?
Tell them that's the easiest trick they have. They offered them freedom. The vast majority, they're not really lieutenants. These were equals. I mean, you had El Rey Zambada, who was Mayo Zambada's brother, who was arrested and testified. He has a life sentence, and the only key to the door of that prison is his cooperation. I believe his sentence will be dramatically reduced as a result of that. You had various people like Chupeta, who was the head of the Norte Valley Cartel in Colombia, who was, talk about assets, who has assets seized close to the $1 billion range. He's looking to get a sentence of 25 years for all his drug trafficking and for an admitted 150-plus murders.
And Mr. Guzman's convictions are 10 counts, but I guess the first count, which concerns extending or running a criminal enterprise, is the one that has a mandatory sentence of life. Is that right?
That is correct. The first count is, by statute, a mandatory sentence of life.
So did you at any point think, well, maybe we'll get off on that count and we'll get, you know, convicted on the other eight or nine?
His was all or nothing. Even though the other counts don't carry mandatory life, he would have received life on any of the other counts.
And in terms of his appeal, will the same team handle his appeal that handled his trial?
We, the three of us, will speak to Mr. Guzman as to who we think would be a good appellate choice, whether he can or will retain counsel for the appeal or whether he has the federal defender's office to handle that. We're not sure at this point.
You spent a lot of time with this guy, a lot of alone time, right, or time in very small groups. Mm-hmm. He has been incarcerated during this period since he was extradited to the United States, he has not been allowed to speak to anybody, right, as I understand it. I mean, he has been completely in isolation. The government thought of him as a risk in so many different ways that they thought it was just not a good idea for really him to have contact with anybody else. Is that right?
That's correct. He was placed on secured administrative measurements, also known as SAMs, which means that he has absolutely no contact with anyone in the prison, not a fellow prisoner, no one. When he is moved from one spot to another spot in the prison itself, the entire prison is locked down so that no one even passes him in a hallway. The only outside contact he has would be with some of the prison guards who are watching him on a 24/7 basis, because he's eyes on 24/7, which includes even keeping a light on in his cell at night so they can keep eyes on him at all that time. And most of those guards are just English speaking, so there's no conversation. So he was really deprived of any human contact whatsoever. So what I felt was important, at least to establish a rapport with him, would be to spend as much time as possible and speak to him. And I believe that he appreciated the amount of time that we sat and talked, even if it had nothing to do with the case, maybe just something about my life or something about his life.
Do you speak Spanish?
I speak very little Spanish, but these law clerks that we have are just wonderful, and they are fluent in multiple languages. One was Spanish.
You prepared this case with him then over the course of a year or so? I mean, how often, how frequently did you see him before the trial began?
I would go up and see him at least 2 to 3 times a month for 3-4 hours at a time, where he was housed at MCC in Manhattan. Early on, the discovery received was overwhelming. It was over 400,000 pages of discovery, which required many, many hours, not just of my time, but of the law clerks going through all that discovery with him. And that doesn't include all the electronic messages which were intercepted and or the phone conversations intercepted.
So and how much time did you ultimately have once the government released their discovery? So they gave you all of this evidence against Mr. Guzman, and you had basically how long to respond?
Well, the 400,000 general pages of discovery, as we call it, was a year in advance. So that was 1 year. But the most important discovery in any criminal case is what's called Jenks, which would be the witnesses, the cooperator's statements, and or the police officer's statements. And we received close to 25,000 pages of that 30 days in advance of the trial. So that was somewhat daunting and overwhelming. And as you know, we asked for a continuance of the trial based on that, and that was denied. So that was an issue, but you do the best you can under the circumstances.
My guest is William Papura. He is one of the defense attorneys in the El Chapo trial, which ended last week in Brooklyn. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. We've talked a little about that sort of mythology that has grown around El Chapo, Mr. Guzman. When he was arrested in Mexico, on many different occasions, there were protests in the streets in favor, supporting El Chapo. You can go to the biggest city in Sinaloa in Mexico and purchase all sorts of El Chapo merchandise. He is a folk hero. How did that play into your understanding of him, your understanding of the case? Was that a good thing, a bad thing, legally? Was it something that mattered once it came to trial?
Well, we tried to demonstrate during the trial, I'm not sure how effective it was, but we tried to demonstrate that he, in fact, was more myth than actual real legend. And that he, as you mentioned earlier, he did enjoy the myth of El Chapo being the Forbes 701st richest person in the country. And there's 701 hats all through Sinaloa and Culiacan in Mexico. So he enjoyed that. So that didn't help him, and it didn't help us as well in trying the case, but that was something that was perpetuated by himself. And what we believe also was perpetuated by Miles Zambada, to Miles Zambada's benefit, because that took the heat off of Mr. Zambada and placed the heat more on Mr. Guzman during this period of time.
Do you have an explanation as to why he seems to be so popular with at least a certain sector of the Mexican public?
Well, he grew up in, as you indicated, extreme poverty. I mean, he was selling oranges on the street when he's 5 years old, and so many other people in that area can relate to that. And from that, he became, as the government portrayed, this multimillionaire, if not billionaire, from dealing in narcotics. So I think that's what
created. So it's a rags to riches story?
Absolutely.
So people just admire him for being able to do it.
They did. And also he gave back to the area that he came from more so than the government. So they were getting more from El Chapo, from Joaquin Guzman, service-wise, than they would from the Mexican government. He built churches, he put roads in, he put school systems in, medical facilities. He put money into that. So the people protected him and loved him. And as you indicated, there was Narco Credos, which are songs about him being sung, and obviously he enjoyed those as well.
You know, churches and roads and the occasional underground tunnel.
Well, it seems like there's a lot of tunnels.
Yeah.
So we can build a wall, but you got to stop the tunnels too, I'm
right.
guessing.
Well, we'll talk about drug policy and border security when we come back after this quick break. More with trial attorney William Purpura after we take a little break. 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page as well. Before we take this break, on Mondays here on our program, it's our practice to read the names of people who've lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 33 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Last week, police released the name of a man who was shot in 2002. He died earlier this month from complications related to that shooting, and his death has now been ruled a homicide by the medical examiner. His name is David Golden. He was 39 years old. Last week, two people, a man and a woman in their 20s, lost their lives to violence in our city. Baltimore police have not yet released their names. Police have identified a homicide victim from the week before last. His name is Dominic Williams. He was 30 years old. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us on this President's Day holiday. If you've just joined us, we're getting a unique perspective on the trial of Joaquin Guzman Loera, known as El Chapo, which means shorty in Spanish. He faces life in prison after his convictions last week on 10 counts related to drug trafficking. My guest was at the trial every day, sitting at the defense table. Now he's sitting at a table here with me in Studio A. William Purpura was one of El Chapo's lawyers. El Chapo is one of many high-profile clients that Bill Purpura has represented in a legal career that spans some 40 years. On Valentine's Day, Senator Ted Cruz, the Texas Republican, published an op-ed in the Washington Post in which he called for building a wall on the southern border and making El Chapo pay for it. What do you think about that idea? You can join us here on Midday, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Let's go to Heather in Baltimore. Heather, welcome to Midday with Bill Purpura.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. And I didn't realize Ted Cruz had said, why don't we take Mexican drug dealers' drug money and pay for the wall, and then the Mexican will have paid for it somewhat, and it doesn't get taken. I'll take the answer off the air. I'm really waiting to hear this one.
Okay, so Mr. Cruz has made a suggestion that's perhaps a little bit tongue-in-cheek about, just having El Chapo pay. I mean, certainly $5.7 billion probably wouldn't be too big a stretch for Mr. Guzman if the reports of his wealth are true. But where does the actual money go eventually? I mean, he is married, for example. He has children and all that stuff. Are they now left destitute? I mean, what happens to the people in his circle and the actual assets? I assume he no longer has access to them.
As I mentioned earlier, perhaps your listener wasn't at the beginning of the program itself, the government has seized, the government of Mexico and or the government of the United States, as far as Joaquin Guzman is concerned, has never, ever seized any assets. Assets being money, assets being yachts, assets being houses or properties.
But can they now because he's convicted?
They would have if they had these things.
They would have seized it
a long time ago. So there's nothing out there that they've been able to find since 1980 through 2017, 2018, and now 2019. So it's highly unlikely that the wall will be funded by Joaquin Guzman. Now, if other narcotic traffickers, the United States or Mexico, have assets which are seized, the United States Treasury is the place that money goes, and that money can be used for such things as that.
How is it that you can have, you could be, putatively have $14 billion worth of assets, and there are some estimates that say it was, you know, billions of dollars, $3 or $4 billion a year they were making in this enterprise, and have none of it traceable or none of it gettable by the government? He must have a great accountant.
Yeah. Other than if he maybe has the greatest accountant ever, and or it's probably, as what I believe and I think we try to show, it's really more myth than legend as to the type of money that he was receiving, whether he is more myth than legend. I mean, he lived like a he lived as a peasant in the hills, in the mountains, even when he was on the run. He wasn't living in the life of luxury during that period of time.
But we heard stories about a diamond-studded handgun that he used, and there he was accused in the trial of committing a number of violent crimes. None of those crimes, the violent crimes, the killings and stuff, didn't happen in the United States. So he wasn't being tried for murder here. But there were an awful lot of stories about some very violent acts in Mexico.
Yeah. Well, two separate questions. Did he have the diamond-studded handgun? The answer is yes. Whether that's a billion-dollar weapon, I doubt it, but he did have that. Actually, I think he had two of those. As far as acts of violence, I mean, assuming the facts of the government portrayed, these were acts of violence in various drug wars, probably larger scale than we have here in Baltimore City, but the people involved were all participants in both sides.
Having gotten to know Mr. Guzman and other people who have been involved in, you know, Latin and Central American drug trades, other clients of yours, what's your personal feeling about the drug policy and the efforts to interdict drugs as they come across the border, and just the general mess that is the opioid crisis that we're currently in here in this country, not just in Maryland, but across the land? I mean, knowing what you know about the inner workings of how this, a lot of this dope gets itself to the shores of the United States, what do you think we should be doing?
You know, in 40 years of doing criminal defense work, working with probably some of the smaller of the dealers here in Baltimore City up to the supposedly largest of them all, Joaquin Guzman, you know, we have seen the government try everything, the war on drugs, mass incarceration. Remember, there is times when people are serving the remainder of their life in prison for small amounts of drugs. We've tried everything, and there's only two things left to do. One would be you can just execute everyone, as they do in perhaps Singapore. Or number two is we'd have to really understand that we have to legalize these drugs coming in. We have to treat the people who want treatment. We have to educate those people and just take the profit out of the drug market.
So sentencing and incarceration, in your view, isn't going to do the trick?
It never has. We've come off mass incarceration for life. We realize that we, as the populace here, we're spending too much money. We're housing people now who are in their 70s and 80s who are no longer a threat but are serving life sentences, and they can't get out, and we're still paying for that. So we want to bring them back into the community.
Just Friday afternoon, President Trump himself said he had a conversation with President Xi of China, and he said to President Xi, "Do you have a drug problem in China?" And President Xi said no. And Mr. Trump allegedly, this is according to him in his press conference the other day, said, "Well, why is that?" And Xi is alleged to have said, "Because we have the death penalty." And so there's Mr. Trump saying, "Well, we could solve this drug thing in a heartbeat, just, you know, execute everybody," as you said. You mentioned Singapore. I mean, what's your response when you hear the President of the United States say that?
It's shocking, obviously. I think it's shocking to any person with a conscience. I mean, you can't possibly think you're going to execute everyone involved in drug trafficking, whether it's Joaquin Guzman or whether it's the young man on a street corner here in Baltimore City. But, you know, that's just, it's ridiculous and heartless at this point to even suggest that.
There's a former assistant or deputy head of the Drug Enforcement Administration who gave an interview to a couple of media outlets talking about the fecklessness of Mr. Trump's contention that a wall would stop drugs from coming into the country. Mr. Guzman, the drugs that came in, it's told, and press reports have said that part of his business plan was to use ports of entry and not to use remote areas of the southern border. Can you shed any light on that? Do you know one way or the other?
Well, I do. What the evidence showed, and this is factual, in this particular case, drugs from the early 80s right on through the present, there's multiple means of entrance to the United States. There was through cars, through trucks, through trains, through planes, and through boats. A small amount was being tunneled in under if you have a wall or a fence into warehouses and then put into trucks or trains after that. So do I think that the wall is going to stop the drugs entering? The answer is clearly no.
And during this period where Mr. Guzman has been incarcerated, awaiting trial and the trial itself, the Sinaloa drug cartel has continued to operate, right?
Whether it's the Sinaloa cartel, whether it's the Juarez cartel or the Tijuana cartel, there has been no abatement in the amount of drugs coming into the United States.
I think the prosecutors in this case would like to assert that now that Mr. Guzman has been taken out of the game, that this is a death knell. This is a death blow to the Sinaloa cartel. What do you think?
I think that's a complete fallacy. As we just indicated, the flow of drugs has not abated at all during the time that he's been arrested since 2016 to the present.
There seems to be a lot of infighting when it comes to these various cartels. I mean, in a way, is the Sinaloa cartel in any way less stable, as it were, or less predictable now that Guzman's out of it? I mean, was he, you're even asserting that he really wasn't the head of it, that there was another guy who was the head of it and continues to be the head of it. But if the prosecutors are right, at least to a certain extent, that Guzman had a very strong influence on the operation of the Sinaloa cartel, now that he's out, is this going to splinter things and can we look forward to even more violence, et cetera?
It's been my thought that the government of Mexico in particular has always preferred to deal with the devil they know than the devil they don't know. And these large cartels, as bad as they were, at least offered some stability. When you break one of these cartels down, then you have, as you mentioned, a lot of infighting. That's what's going on in Mexico now.
Mr. Lichtman, one of your fellow teammates on the defense team, said that part of the appeal is going to be that he should never have been extradited from Mexico to begin with, that this trial or a trial like this should have happened in Mexico rather than the United States. What do you give the chances of that prevailing in the appeals process?
Well, I'm not sure how effective that would be here in the United States. What happened in this particular case is normally you as a Mexican citizen get to contest extradition, and Joaquin Guzman was denied that. He was just sent here without the normal procedures in Mexico. But that's more of a Mexican policy than a policy in the United States.
We just got a couple seconds left.
Sure.
Is there any chance that he or anybody else can escape from the maximum security prison in Colorado where he's likely to be incarcerated?
There's always a chance, but I doubt that'll ever happen, Tom.
All right. William Papura was part of the defense team in the trial of El Chapo, which concluded last week. Bill, thank you so much for your time. It's been fascinating.
Thank you, Tom.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Midday on the Environment. We'll take a look at the Green New Deal. That's a proposal introduced last Friday by New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. They call it, quote, a comprehensive agenda of economic, social, and racial justice. Republicans have called it zany and loony. We'll explore what's in it and whether it's the best way to address climate change and the other challenges facing the United States and the world. My guest will be Tom Pelton of the Environmental Integrity Project, Bob Sussman, a former EPA official, and Julian Noisecat, an environmental expert from the advocacy organization 350.org. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. We want to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served every weekend. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. Here and Now is up next after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your listening. Have a great day.